few months ago, some work was done on the road that goes past our neighborhood where we live, Indian Trail. And because they were going to tear up the road, and because Indian Trail is the only road through that part of the neighborhood, it's on a bench there above the river, and each bench drops down, but at that part of the bench, it's the only through road there is in some sections. And so they put signs out, warning signs, that they were going to be working on the road for certain dates and times, and that there'd be a backup of traffic and some stoppage as well. And that gave you, because you saw the sign, it gave you an opportunity to take a detour if you needed to, or to go around all the way the other ends, because you were going to be tied up in the middle. And so it gave you a chance to make a choice and to avoid some of the problems that could possibly arise. It turned out that the construction was just an inconvenience. If you had a little bit of patience, you could just wait in line until you went through, or slow down a bit to get past the equipment that was there. But what if the signs at either end of the road work would have said, road washed out? To continue then would have been rather foolish, wouldn't it? I mean, if the sign said road washed out, and you said, ah, that's okay, we'll just go on through anyway. One time I did that. I hate to say, but I keep thinking, you know, I must have done one of everything, and most I shouldn't, but one time I literally did that. It was at night on the road I was traveling on. The sign said, bridge out. I said, well, that's no problem. And went right past the bridge out sign and kept right on going down. And eventually, right there was this bridge out place. And I said, well, that's no problem. So, you know, I got up pretty close to it and spent the night there with my front wheels hanging over the end of the roadway in the air and high-centered in the middle, and I guess it was a problem, but I spent the night there with my car hanging over the front, and I had to wait till morning to go find someone to tow me back out. Now, the fact is, when the sign says bridge out, you might want to seriously consider taking a detour. It isn't going to be just an inconvenience. It could be a very critical thing. God expects us to respond appropriately to the circumstances that we find ourselves in. He wants us to make choices. He wants us to heed the warnings, and He wants us to respond appropriately. In Proverbs 26, in verse number 4, is a dichotomy here is almost set up in terms of how we should respond. It says, do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you also be like him. And then it says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. And so it sets up again the fact that we need to respond using wisdom according to the circumstances that we find ourselves in. Now, there's a lot of application of that, and in different ways. In Matthew 10, when Christ was preparing the disciples to go out with power and authority to represent Him, He gave them instructions, and then He gave them a warning. And in Matthew 10, verse 1, He says, when He had called His 12 disciples to Him, He gave them power over unclean spirits to cast them out, to heal all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease. So God was with them, working through them miraculously, no questions asked. And yet, in verse number 16, He says, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, therefore be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Now, because God gave them power, He surely could have given them the power that the wolves would not be a risk or a danger to them as sheep, as the analogy would go. They had power over unclean spirits. They had power to cast out disease and to represent God in that way and to actually choose someone indeed who would be healed. God gave them remarkable gifts and abilities, and yet He said, I want you still to choose. I'm with you, but I want you to choose carefully what it is that you will do. Matthew chapter 7, again related to this in a little different way. Christ here teaching about prayer, on going to God and submitting to Him, on choosing the right course, the right path, on understanding the results of circumstance by knowing people by their fruits. And He says in verse 24, therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them I will liken to a wise man who built his house on a rock. He says, you know, if you're building in a foundation for a house and you're going to build on something to be solid and stable, he says you need to build it in a certain way. When they built our house, they did a good job on the foundation and they disturbed all the rest of the ground around it, and then they went and poured the floor without properly preparing the sand. Is our house is on sand. Hope it's okay with God, but it's the way they built out there. And the floor sunk. The floor in the family room was 4 inches down on one corner. The steps outside the family room are 4 inches down on one side. You know, a couple beers, you walk out the steps, you think it's over, you know. It leans off to the side. But it says, whoever hears these sayings of mine, we're talking now wisdom, using good judgment and making good decisions, and uses these things and does them, is like a man who built his house on a rock. The rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew, beat on that house, and it did not fall. It was founded on a rock. Everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them, doesn't apply it, makes wrong decisions, doesn't heed the warning signals, keeps on down the road even though the sign says bridge out, is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew, beat on the house, and it fell, and great was the fall. How wise are we, brethren, in the way we live our lives before God? If indeed there is the possibility of a detour ahead, don't we want to be sure that we're reading the signs? Don't we want to be sure that we're actively making choices? I take U.S. News and World Report, read a number of things, but in the current issue of U.S. News, I believe right now in society and the economy and around this nation and the world, there's some warning signs out. And I want to bring a few of those signs to you and present them for your consideration, because I believe that if I did not, in this sense, give you warning, that I would be accountable as well, because you need to begin to process what choices you will make in your lives as a result. And so I feel very much an obligation to address some of these issues. But this was in the current U.S. News. It's on the newsstand today. It's by the editor-in-chief. It's Mortimer Zuckerman. He's the editor-in-chief. And it's about Japan and the economy there and what the effects could possibly be. And I'd like to read some of it to you. It says, in the late 1980s, the acreage around the Emperor's Palace in Tokyo was reputedly worth more than all of California, and Japan itself was valued in excess of the continental United States. Now, that's a rather high assessment. The economy there was way, way overbuilt and blown and assessed. It says, then the bubble burst, and in the 1990s, real estate values declined as much as 80% through the country, and equities by 60%. Now, as I read this to you, I want you to understand, this is not Chicken Little speaking. This is the editor of U.S. News and World Report. This is not somebody that came in off the street and had a message to give us and say, I'm trying to pick resources that have a measure of credibility as I show you what is presently in place. The loss of over $8 trillion in value represents the largest collapse of wealth in the history of the world, and it goes on. The economy is contracting at an annual rate of over 5%. 5% inflation is pretty good inflation in these present days. 5% contraction after an 80% loss of value is still pretty significant. Some people take satisfaction in Japan's travails. This is short-sighted. We are all bound up in the fate of Japan. Do not ask for whom the bell tolls. It is reminiscent of our Great Depression, and no remedy seems to work. The government has tried to reflate the economy several times through $550 billion in tax cuts and public works spending. Consumers, though, see growing unemployment and a recession without end. The loan exposure of the major Japanese banks is approximately 150% of their capital and reserves. 150%. Of their capital and reserves, almost three times as much in percentage terms as the worst that U.S. banks have faced in recent years. There are hundreds of billions of dollars in upcoming pension liabilities and billions more of off-balance sheet unsecured debt in corporations, government agencies, and home mortgages. He says, not even the most skilled of accountants and financial people can estimate the true extent of the exposure or gauge the bottom. It is Japan's worst economic crisis since the end of World War II. No one knows what to do about it, and we are all at risk. What's the largest economy in the world? What is the largest economy in the whole world? United States. What's the second largest economy in the whole world? Japan. Not China, not Russia or the Soviet Union or what's left of it, or Germany or anybody else. The second largest economy in the world is Japan. How can, he says, it is the greatest financial crisis in modern times. How can the world's second largest economy be rescued from a spiral of deflation and decline? Start with Japan's ineffectual attempts to stimulate its economy, add contracting trade with Asia, and the nation might be sucked into intractable depression. If this causes the yen to collapse, it might well trigger a new round of competitive currency devaluations among other countries in Asia, including China, which might lead, he says, to a global slump and a collapse of confidence in the world financial system. Make no mistake, America will not or would not escape the consequences. Unless Japan's leadership is galvanized, its rising sun will be transformed into a setting sun, and a dark shadow will fall over the industrialized world. Now, I remind you again, brethren, that's not Chicken Little speaking. It's the reality of the circumstance in the second largest economy in the world today. And because our economy is the strongest, and it is strong at this moment, we are holding and propping up much of the economies of the world as a result. What Mr. Zuckerman was saying is, says that we are at incredible risk at this time. I hold that out to you as a road sign for you to take caution from and make appropriate decisions according to your circumstances. Obviously, you and I and others, for Japan's sake and our own, hope that those things don't come to pass in a way that continues to decline. But to ignore what is happening in the world economy today, at the very least, is naive. And at the most, I believe, would be fundamentally unwise. My purpose today is not to tell you the end is here, or to get up with my sign and say, flee from the wrath to come. That's not my purpose. My purpose is not even primarily to focus on the return of Jesus Christ, although I don't think we ever want to leave that out or ignore it by any means. But that is not my purpose either. My purpose is to look at some of the signposts that I believe are out there today through wisdom and be warned and forewarned in the light of the events that we may possibly or will surely face ahead, and make our appropriate decisions accordingly. And I honestly, I feel absolutely obligated to at least comment on some of these things in this way. MSNBC is Microsoft's news service that they provide, and I had a report that John Gould down in Kennewick shared with me that came off of the MSNBC news service. And it had to do with the utilities and some of the public held corporations here in the United States that provide service in this country. And it was dated June the 12th. And the headline here, which is rather extensive, says, utility experts were not able to promise Friday that the United States would remain plugged in January the 1st, 2000, the day the year 2000 bug hits. They testified before a new Senate year 2000 committee whose chairman believes that if today were January 1, 2000, the nation's power grid would fail. Now, that seems pretty dramatic. Seems extreme. John Gould gave a sermonette down in Kennewick on the millennium bug in the computers, and I'm not a technician, but suffice it to say that the programming in the computers one day was built in such a way that you would have trouble come the year 2000 in the computers rotating over to that year and knowing what to do. Now, that sounds too simple and too easy, and it sounds, here comes Chicken Little again, raiding through the courtyard. There have been two different corporations that I have personally read about where when the first person walked in with a credit card that had the year 2000 on it, it shut down the entire corporate computer system that was online. Now, we're talking maybe 12, 14 stores in a number of states. But because the programming was not set up to handle that change, it not only shut down the system and the store they used it, but because this is all interconnected, it went through the system and shut down the other stores as well. And it took a week or two to solve the problems and bring them back up to steam. So those issues were solved. But I want to read you what came out of this. The chairman of the committee, Robert Bennett, is a Republican from Utah. And they're doing a they had a survey that was done that was being reported on. He said he did a survey in his office. He sent to 10 of the nation's largest electric, oil, and gas utilities showing their preparations to ward off the year 2000 bugs and found that the preparations were lagging. They weren't up to steam. Eight of the companies had not even finished assessing their automated systems, the first step in tackling the problem. He says, I had anticipated that I'd be able to provide a positive report on the year 2000 status of these public utilities, he said. Instead, based on the results of the survey, I am genuinely concerned about the real prospects of power shortages as a consequence of the millennial date change. Again, this is a congressional committee that assembled to assess the damage or the risk. It was Bennett who warned that he felt there was a 100% chance the U.S. power grid would collapse if today were January 1, 2000. What do you think the chance, the estimate he made of the power grid collapsing in the year 2000 with the knowledge that we now have and the efforts that are being made to solve the problem? Anybody want to guess? What did he look down the road, knowing this is coming, people trying to solve it, what was his guess that the chance of a power grid failure would be? 40%. That's pretty significant. If I was had a gun and two bullets in it and a couple of chambers that were empty and a couple that were full, that'd be like 50%. And I don't think I'd stick it up to my head and take a chance. So, you know, I hope this is not right and that it won't happen, but I'm just saying again, there are some signs out in our economy and around the world today about things that we ought to stop and take recognition of. Senator Chris Dodd, Democrat from Connecticut, the committee co-chair, was as pessimistic as Bennett, saying he feared many government and business leaders had not even yet drafted contingency plans. Brethren, we do face in various ways the possibility of some major disruptions ahead. Proverbs 6 addresses in principle what I believe, at least in part, our perspective should be. I'd like to just sit back and say, look, everything's fine, don't worry, it'll work out, God's in charge, just carry on with your life. I'd like to say that. I don't believe I honestly, in good conscience, can. Proverbs 6, verse 6, go to the ant, you sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer, gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, and so shall your poverty come on you like a robber, and your need like an armed man. You know, the ant, by example, is shown that when the time of production is available, he produces. When the time of harvest is required, he harvests. And when the time of need is there, then he has provided and made preparation for that time of need. Now, that's pretty simple. In an agricultural society, that's pretty standard. How many thousand jars, collectively among us, canning jars, do you think we've given away over the last 10 years? I mean, There was a time in society when it was absolutely normal to can and prepare during harvest and during times when produce was available, and then to use that for the times it was not. It was just part of society. Nobody thought otherwise about it. We live in a society now, though, where you can buy bananas 52 weeks out of the year. If Peru's not harvesting, then somewhere else is. And so we have got the concept in this society we live in that it's always available and it will always be there. And the fact is it will not always be available and it will not always be there. And I have to tell you, I believe indeed that is so. Today, I think a good example of how we function is in the auto industry and specifically in General Motors. What is the name of the principle that General Motors operated on that allowed the unions to shut down basically the entire company? Well, they operate on a principle called just in time. Just in time means if you're building a car tomorrow, you make sure the parts are shipped in today because you don't want to pay for inventory. You don't want to pay for the extra storage. You don't want to pay for all the value of the parts. You just want them to come in the door. You build the car goes out the door, called just in time. Well, that's how the stores operate as well. It's called just in time, effectively. In fact, it's part and parcel of this society. We bring it in as we need it and as we consume it, and then it goes out the door. And because General Motors was set up that way, when they shut down a parts plant that was making parts, just in time could not solve the problem for the plant that needed the parts. And so that plant shut down, and the next plant shut down, and effectively it went through the company and has idled almost all the production that there is. It's a different system than used to exist. Our society functions in a different way. Our margins of safety are much thinner than they have ever been. Brethren, I think now is a good time to rebuild some of the margins in our lives. I would like to, from my perspective and understanding, as I believe, I would like to warn you, now is a good time to rebuild some of the margins in our lives. Last night I was working at the computer. It was midnight. And there was a bang on the window right above my desk. And I looked up and the stacked chairs off of the patio had just blown off. And there was wind going outside and rain lashing. And I thought, oh, okay, lightning crashing in the background. So I decided I'd better print off my notes as quickly as I could. Immediately called for a copy of my notes, saved them, printed the notes, shut down the computer, pulled the plug from the wall, walked upstairs, and within 15 minutes, the power was down. That whole section where we were, it was out. And I looked outside, and there were boards off the fence, and the big tent over the tarp was torn and shredded, and the table on our back patio, it's a plastic table, but it's a table on our back patio, was in the intersection and across the street down the road. Now, I don't know how it got there. I don't know if it went up there like Wizard of Oz, you know, over the top, or blew through, but it went past the house next to us and across, and our houses overlap, so it's not like there's an open shot there somewhere. I don't know how it did this, but it was clear across the street in the intersection on the end. And the metal chairs were tossed, a big gust came through, but we went over, and Michelle and Megan this weekend are taking care of some horses in a barn right down in the neighborhood. And we went down to the barn, some of the barn doors and gates and stuff, not gates, but the window, the gates on the doors on the barn itself had been blown open, and we had to put that back together. Now, that was kind of a simple thing, really. I guess our power has only been out twice in the last few weeks. I wasn't here for the ice storm when you all went through that, and I guess good thing it was in winter because then the freezer stayed froze, but maybe not a good thing if you had to heat the house with something that needed electricity or otherwise. But we had better make some provisions, brethren, for the possibility of power going out for more than an inconvenient period of time. Now, we can say, well, that didn't happen. There's no chance of that. Well, don't tell the Senate committee that was investigating the utilities, there's no chance of that, or they're just absolutely losing their marbles. You know, we have to do our part. We have to do our job. God will surely do His. But understand how God works with us in that process to bless our efforts. In 2 Kings 4 is the story of Elijah and the widow. And in verse number 1, God works through us to bless the things that we choose and the things that we do. He doesn't always do them for us exclusively and separately from any effort that we make. A certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried to Elisha, saying, excuse me, it's Elisha, I said Elijah, your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor is coming to take my two sons to be his slaves. And Elisha said to her, what shall I do to you? Tell me, what do you have in the house? And she said, your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil. He says, well, go and borrow vessels from everywhere, from all your neighbors, empty vessels, do not gather just a few. And when you've come in, you have shut the door behind you and your sons, pour into all of those vessels and set aside the full ones. And she went from him, shut the door behind her and her sons, who brought the vessels to her, and she poured it out. Now it came to pass when the vessels were full, she said to her son, bring me another vessel. And he said to her, there is not another vessel. And so the oil ceased. Then she came and told the man of God, and he said, go sell the oil, pay your debt, you and your sons live on the rest. If she had brought in 10 vessels, it would appear from the story that as soon as those 10 vessels were full, the oil would have ceased. If she brought in 50 vessels, it would appear that the oil would not have ceased until all 50 were full. In other words, she was told to go out and prepare, and don't prepare with just a few. But then she had to choose what proper wisdom in that case would be, whether it was worth her effort, whether it was prudent, whether it was asking too much, what it was she could afford to try to acquire. And God blessed her accordingly. I really do believe, in principle, that's significant. This morning I got up, apparently the power stayed on down at the newspaper, and I picked it up, and the headline says, Russian leader warns of social something. The copy machine cuts off right there. I think it says unrest or something, upheaval, I forget what it said. It says, Russia's escalating financial crisis is fomenting social unrest, and debts have amassed to a shocking 44% of the country's net worth. Now, let me describe that in rounded terms. Let's say both husband and wife and your family work, and together you make $50,000, both incomes together. And you have a credit card, and the interest on your credit card is 100%, not 18% or 21%, 100%, that's the interest rate in Russia on their treasury bills or whatever they call the things they have, the securities they have there that are issued for the government. So you have a 100% interest rate on your credit card. You make $50,000 household income, and on your credit cards are $25,000 in debt. Now, have you got a financial crisis or what? How long is it going to take to have a financial crisis? Not very long. Less than 30 days ago, the percentage of debt, governmental debt, in Russia, or as it says here, Russia, was less than 33%. In 30 days, they've gone from less than 33 to 44% in 30 days nationally, and they're still beholding debt at 100% interest to keep the government afloat. Now, is that Chicken Little or what? If Japan indeed is the second largest economy, Russia was Soviet Union, but you know, Russia collectively is what's left, was the second largest power in the world. And the ramification of what is taking place in this regard is significant. It's not incidental at all. It just goes through in the article, read your paper. Some of you probably read it this morning before you came to church. There's a note in the middle of it. It says, the cash-strapped Russian military has apparently found a new way to cut costs. It's been feeding some soldiers with canned dog food instead of meat. You think it's life's not tough over there? They found 100 tons of dog food in one of the food depots, and now they're inspecting the rest of the depots for the soldiers' storage of food. They can't afford to pay everybody, and frankly, it looks like they can't afford to feed everybody, so they've started feeding dog food to the soldiers. It's about what we ate when I was in the Army here, so, you know, maybe it's connected. I remember corned beef, you could not even chew. I remember, I could go on, I don't try not to, but I remember one time one of the cooks put green food coloring in the creamed beef for breakfast, and it was terrible. You have this green stuff you put on your plate, and you're just, but, I mean, they're feeding them dog food. It's hard times. And these are, like I said, if we think that these things cannot affect us, then I have to say that I believe at the very least that's naive, and at the worst it's a very incredible lack of wisdom at its worst. The world is not the same as it used to be. I don't think we should be living our lives just like business as usual, as if it'll go on, it'll be fine, don't have to worry about these things, trust God. Don't you think the widow trusted God? Don't you think that Elisha trusted God, and yet did not God bless according to the effort that she made as well? Did he not intercede on her behalf accordingly? Genesis 41. Here we have the account of Pharaoh's dream with Joseph. It says, it came to pass at the end of 2 full years, because Joseph had been in prison, that Pharaoh had a dream. Behold, he stood by a river, and there came up out of the river 7 cows, fine-looking, fat, and they fed in the meadow. Then, behold, 7 other cows came up after them out of the river, ugly and gaunt, stood by the other cows on the bank of the river, and the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the 7 fine-looking, fat ones, and so Pharaoh awoke. Needed some Tums or something, I suppose, here, after a dream like that. But now you know the story, because it goes on, it gives another dream. He went back to sleep, he dreamed another time, and this time it was heads of grain and full and plump ones, and then they were eaten up by the lean ones. And so the story was that there would be 7 years of plenty, and then there would be 7 years of lean and of desperation. And when you knew that there was a time of abundance, because God showed them the meaning of this, they were supposed to then put back something in reserve for the lean times ahead. Part of the trouble we're having in the United Church of God now is there were no reserves. There was nothing to fall back on. There was nowhere to go to soften the transition that we found ourselves in. Verse 46, Genesis 41, Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh, went throughout all the land of Egypt, and now in the 7 plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years which were in the land of Egypt, laid up the food in the cities. He laid up in every city the food of the fields that surrounded them. He gathered very much grain as the sand of the sea until he stopped counting, for it was without number. I'm not suggesting that you go out and gather grain as the sand of the sea. But brethren, I do believe there are some signposts out. I believe there are some legitimate warnings that are in front of us, and I would feel negligent if I did not point some of them out to you. You have to make that choice. You have to take an appropriate course of action. It is your life. But again, I feel obligated to at least warn you in this regard. Mr. Armstrong, in the last years of his life, regularly encouraged us to focus on what came to be called the 3 mandates. Because of what he believed was then coming ahead, and there were issues that he wanted to see addressed in the church. And the first was to come out of the world. The second was to simplify your life, at least as it came to be called. And the third was to prepare to teach. Now, I have focused, I believe, on coming out of the world, and I have focused, I believe, on preparing to teach and our responsibility as a witness and example and to serve before God in our calling in that way. Mr. Armstrong encouraged and enjoined us to step back from around the things that are around us and change our focus, to reject some of society's values and pursuits, and to focus on our unique and special calling. And in the midst of that, he tucked in, simplify your life. And the way he worded it initially was to prepare to greatly reduce your standard of living. You remember that, those of you that were in the church and reading and aware of what he was addressing at those times. He said, prepare to greatly reduce your standard of living. Now, in my sermon last week, I showed that we have gone from a nation under God to a largely godless nation in most of our lifetimes. Basically from World War II, maybe Dwight Eisenhower's time till today, that transition has taken place. Mr. Armstrong warned us in his lifetime that economic distress comes oftentimes because of unrighteousness, partly because of the bad judgments that are therefore made by the people, and partly because of God's removal of His blessings, because the people become ungodly. Now, on our scale, in the human scale, maybe he was a little bit ahead of his time, because he died and life went on. In fact, life got fat after he died, did it not? Some of the best increase in the markets and growth in this country that has ever been seen. But on God's scale, I have to believe that he was right on target where God wanted him to be. I believe we had better be putting our houses in order, brethren. I believe that we had best be getting out of debt, as we had been encouraged many other times to do, and that I believe we should be making some preparations for possible disruptions to come. You better decide what appropriate and proper and godly detours indeed are available and take access or advantage of them when you can. In Babylon that we live in the midst of, we have so much that it is hard for us to believe that there won't be plenty more tomorrow forever. Even though we know the prophecies and we know, yes, ultimately these things are going to take place, I have specifically avoided pestilence and disease and wars and rumors of wars because we have covered those and focused on those in many different ways. And I have tried to offer things that I felt were from sources that were credible in real time, which and not just something that would be a shock or an overblown issue to us at all. Revelation 18 describes Babylon's fall. Obviously, Babylon's fall is down the road. But as it falls, notice how it is described. Revelation 18, verse 9, says, the kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, that great city, Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. It's not a decline that goes for hundreds of years. It's a decline that is instantaneous. And maybe decline is even not a good term. It's like consumption is immediate. In 1 hour, your judgment has come, and the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and every kind of wood, special woods and ivory objects and every kind of most precious woods and bronze and iron and marble and cinnamon and incense. And it goes on and on. A trading economy that is beyond measure on a worldwide scale, and it comes to nothing in an hour, in a moment, and it's over. Flour and wheat and cattle and sheep and horses and chariots, and it says, in bodies and souls of men. Now, while there may indeed be physical slavery, I believe that the context here is financial and economic, and I believe that that slavery most fully is economic. And the fruit that your soul longed for has gone from you, and all the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more at all. And the merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, saying, "Alas, alas, the great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple, scarlet, adorned with pearls, precious stones. For in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing." And it goes on, and it continues to describe it in verse number 19. "For in 1 hour she is made desolate." It just wraps up all at once when the time comes. Verse 21 says, "Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone, threw it in the sea, said, 'Thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down, shall not be found any more. The sound of harpists and musicians and flutists and trumpeteers shall not be heard in you anymore.'" Music is something you do that is a luxury. It's something that you do after you have the necessities met. It's a great blessing and opportunity that goes beyond survival. And it says you're not going to have those luxuries anymore. "No craftsman of any craft will be found in you anymore. The sound of a millstone will not be heard in you anymore. The light of the lamp won't shine in you anymore, and the voice of the bridegroom and the bride won't be heard. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, for by your sorcery all the nations were deceived." Sorcery of what? Of the merchandising that they offered, of the materialism that was offered and spread and cast out before us all. "And in her was found the blood of prophets and saints, all of who were slain on the earth." So it's a system that in the end is not going to be user-friendly to the church. Mr. Armstrong encouraged us to come out of this world's values and this system. And he encouraged us to do so in a timely and godly manner. Now is a good time, brethren, to begin to strengthen your faith, because I believe our faith is indeed going to be tested. I believe our faith is already being tested. Got a call from a friend last night. He said, "We started out in the Worldwide Church of God," and he said, "then I was in the United Church of God," and he said, "then I was in the Church of God." We're talking pretty short here. And he said, "now I have to kind of admit that really what I am is unaligned." You know, a dear personal friend of mine, and I love him. And we're still close and intimate personal friends. And yet, basically what he was just saying is, you know, you lose faith in one item, and then you lose faith in something else, and then you lose faith in something else, and pretty soon it's really hard to have faith. Our big church is gone. Our one single leader is gone. Our big budgets are gone. And for some, their confidence is gone as well. God hasn't changed, though. God is still there. And we need to have faith in Him. Faith in God. Not in the organization, not in the pastor, not in each other. Yes, we should have a certain faith, but I mean ultimately, our faith must be in God. Not in our numbers, not in our personal things that we can see and touch and feel. We can't really afford to have any overriding faith in anything but God. But faith, as James says, without works is dead. So if we think that by faith alone we are saved, well, okay, fine, but God still worked through the pots that the widow gathered. And I believe we have a responsibility, as the Bible has given by example, time and time and time again, to do our part. Faith without works is dead, but I do want to warn you and caution you, brethren, to begin to process the fact that there are troubles and risks ahead, which we may well sail through, and I hope for God's sake, the church's sake, the work's sake, that we do, for the sake of us as a unit. But there are warnings out there, and I don't believe we're going to sail through all of them, frankly. And I think some are going to come home to roost. We must have faith. We must not let our faith be shaken. But we must also be willing to do our part as well. We must be willing to read those signs that are there, and we must choose to act accordingly in our service before God and according to His will.